Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and let's get going. We're going to look at the first carbon tax in North America. We'll hear from one Canadian scientist, recorded just before the government ordered him muzzled. That is Dr. John Fife. But first, let's find out why the American West is drying out with Robert Kunzig of National Geographic magazine. The Great American West is a popular place to live. Cities and suburbs there have grown by 10% in just the last 8 years, but can it last? The February issue of National Geographic features an article not on exotic nature far away, but about the possible end of the Southwest population boom. Author Robert Kunzig writes about the drying of the West. We have him on the line now. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Well, what is happening to the water supply of the Colorado Basin?
For the past 8 years, there has been a record drought in the Colorado River Basin, the worst drought that has been seen since stream flow records have been kept for the past century. And the levels of the two main reservoirs there, Lake Powell behind the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Mead behind the Hoover Dam near Las Vegas, are below 50% of capacity. In 1999, when the drought started, they were essentially full. And so they've just been going down. Last year was not the worst year was 2002, when the Colorado flow was only about a quarter of its long-term average. So it's really gotten people's attention, and water managers around the region are very nervous and have recently negotiated, after years of trying to prepare themselves for how to deal with what they thought were going to be water surpluses, they've had to negotiate a deal for how to deal with shortages like they've never seen before.
This seems like a really big story, which I haven't heard a lot about. How did you encounter it?
Well, I've been working for the past few years on a book on climate, which is called Fixing Climate. It is coming out in just a couple of months for R. Strauss. And I was looking, and it's with a co-author, a well-known science climate scientist called Wally Broker of Columbia University, and we were looking for things to focus on that we think are really going to be the main impacts of global warming, or the ones that are most likely to get people moving. And I got interested in drought in the American West that way. And all, especially, my co-author's specialty is paleoclimate, and so there's been an awful lot of work on the past climate variability of the American West, and that's one of the new developments that has gotten people worried about the future.
Is the drying of the West debatable? I mean, how sure are scientists and water experts that this is really happening?
Well, there's no debate about the current drought, and there is no debate either about what I was just talking about, the past. What people have come to realize in the past decade or so by studying tree rings and other records of past climate is that we have just lived through one of the wettest periods in climate history in the West, of going back over the past 1,000 or 1,500 years. The century in which the West was really settled and the population boom turns out to have been one of the wettest ones. And in particular, the moment in time when the Colorado River water was divided up, when the states signed a compact called the Colorado River Compact, that was in 1922, was really practically the wettest quarter century of the past millennium. If you look back further in the record, to the Middle Ages especially, there were mega droughts that lasted longer than anything we've seen and were also deeper and more severe than anything we've seen. There's no doubt about is that that we have been lucky. And so even if there were no global warming, we should expect for droughts to hit the West unlike any we've ever seen. Now, there is global warming. And the science lately has been moving towards a consensus on what the impacts of that are going to be, and it very likely is going to lead to further drying of the West. This is, the future is less certain than the past, of course, but there was a paper in Science Magazine, a very influential paper just last year, that used looked at all the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change forecasting models, big computer models developed around the planet in different laboratories by people working independently, and it looked at the ensemble of 19 models and found that 18 of them forecast serious drying between now and 2050 for the world.
Well, I wonder how consistent the drying pattern is. I mean, it's confusing, the global warming issue, for all of us. There have been great droughts in the American West before, as you point out, so we don't really need human-induced climate change as a cause. And the current drought was caused by a cooling of water, we think, in the eastern Pacific. So how do humans figure into that overall picture?
Well, you're quite right. And before I answer that, let me just say that when I've been saying the West, but really what I'm talking about is, especially when looking at the forecast for the future, is the Southwest. So I believe you're in Canada. The forecast is not at all the same for Canada as it is for Arizona and Southern California. Now, as for the Southwest, what the climate models say the impact of global warming should be on that area is it should lead to further drying, not just in the Southwest, but in general to the subtropical regions around the world, including the Mediterranean, in Europe, and Australia, in the other hemisphere. There are two reasons why those should get drier. Basically, the models show that regions that are already dry should get drier. And that's a kind of a, it sounds somewhat counterintuitive, but it's a result basically of more evaporation and precipitation happening as you warm up the planet. So there are these atmospheric circulation patterns that keep the deserts dry by transporting water vapor out of them towards the tropics and towards the northern, farther, the polar lat, closer to the poles, the mid-latitudes. Mm-hmm. Basically, in global warming, that transport is going to increase. So regions that are dry are going to get drier, and regions that are wet are going to get wet.
Well, so the American Southwest is in one of these bands of predicted drying.
Yeah, it's right on the edge of it, and that's where the second factor comes in. The models almost all show that these bands should be expanding north and southwards towards the poles. In other words, the subtropical climate bands will be moving poleward. And since the American Southwest is right now on the edge of it, with that effect, it'll be sort of plunged into the middle of it. So that explains why these models forecast a general drying in the Southwest. But it is a complicated business, and they don't they've over the past decade or so, they've been getting ever more fine-grained in their forecast, but they're still not down to the level of being able to say, well, you know, the forecast for western Colorado is definitely this. So there is still some uncertainty, but there has been a definite trend towards a consensus of less water flowing in western.
Well, surely a prolonged drought will create water wars between city dwellers and farmers wanting it for irrigation, or even struggles between big cities. Are planners already working on this?
Yes, they are to some extent. I would say, in general, the reality of global warming has not really set in. I would say water managers don't quite know yet how to deal with it. And because there is still some uncertainty, the forecast, it's really not sure how to respond. But they have been clobbered by the recent drought, and they are just trying to deal with that. And in that context, the seven states of the Colorado River Basin recently signed an agreement in December on what to do if there ever is just not enough water in Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam to satisfy the needs of California, Arizona, and Nevada, which are the downstream states. This has never happened before. In other words, the federal government, the Department of the Interior, which runs Hoover Dam, has never had to say, sorry, we can't release the water that you're entitled to because it's just not there. But they're now looking at that possibility, and they've allocated. They're saying, okay, who's going to get caught off first? Well, it's going to be Arizona because they basically got their slice of pie latest, and then Nevada, and finally California. But that's only for they've only really settled what'll happen with the first shortfall. If things get as bad as some of the models say it could get, well, they're going to have to talk some more.
We're talking with Robert Kunzig, the author of The Drying of the West, and it's published in the February 2008 issue of National Geographic. Well, Robert, if you had to pinpoint some endangered cities due to water shortages, which ones stand out?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I would accept the term endangered cities. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not sure that any of these... I'm not saying that cities are going to become depopulated. But where the boom in population might be threatened, well, the most directly threatened, I would say, is Las Vegas. Nevada gets essentially all its water from the Colorado River. Southern Nevada, which is where most of the people are in Nevada, which is where Las Vegas is. Las Vegas has been, its population has tripled since 1980, and it is still growing fast. It's over 2 million. The water manager I talked to said she fully expects it to go to 3 million. They are doing a lot to conserve water. They've actually, in recent years, been reducing their water use in spite of the growing population. I mean, they're paying people to rip up their lawns and plant desert plants and all other conservation measures. But eventually, something's going to...
You know, this is what's always killed me about many of these cities. When you visit them, you see the sprinklers running nonstop to run lawns, which is totally... opposite to what the natural growth would like to be. And you say Las Vegas has turned that around. I've heard they're paying people so much a square foot to rip out their lawns and put in things that can live there.
They were paying, as of last year, they were paying $2 a square foot, but only up to 1,500 square feet or anything. And just yesterday I was reading that they've changed the program. It's now $1.50 a square foot, but it's essentially unlimited. You can... In other words, they want people to start taking out big areas. And it is already against the law, as I understand it, to plant a new front lawn in Las Vegas. If you build a new house, you can't have a lawn. And I ran into this in other... I talked to water managers in Phoenix and in Albuquerque. The conservation is happening in these places. I mean, I think the outlook is changing. The idea that you should... move west from the east, as so many people have done, and plant the exact same things you grew back home in Ohio or in New York. That is, I think, falling out of style. They're making serious efforts, but as one of the people told me, eventually growth catches up with you. You can't conserve your way out of a shortage that is driven by population.
Robert, can we talk for a minute about the trees and maybe the insects or fire? What's happening with the trees as this drying appears to continue?
Well, there's been in the Southwest, particularly, a major tree die-off covering several million acres, especially of pinyon pine. And it's ultimately caused by the drought. The drought... it may well favor the infestation by bark beetles because it makes the trees more vulnerable and less able to repel the attack of the beetles. But ultimately, drought is the cause. The drought also favors forest fires. And since the 80s, there's been in the western U.S., there's been a very large increase in the area damaged by forest fires. So, quite apart from the drought, connected with both drought and the rising temperatures, it's just changing the climate zone. So in Arizona, for instance, you have these very lovely ecosystems that are known as sky islands because they're mountains that are sort of cool oases in a sea of desert. And as you climb up one of these mountains, I went to Tucson, which is, and if you go to the mountain just north of Tucson, Mount Lemmon, if you drive up from the Sonoran Desert, and you're surrounded by saguaro cactuses, and within less than an hour, you've climbed 7,000 feet, and at the top, you're in a cool pine forest. And so these, basically, you've traversed several distinct ecosystems along the way, and basically those bands are moving up the slope, and the ones at the top are getting pinched off, and so they're on some of these islands there are endemic species that have been sort of hanging out there since the Ice Age, and they are endangered.
And what role do melting glaciers or changed snowfall play in this water supply problem?
Glaciers probably not so much in the United States, although that is a big issue, as I guess you know, in places like China and India, which get a lot of their water from the Himalayan glaciers. But it's the same thing, really. The United States, the western United States, the snowpack is essentially the biggest reservoir for water. So, and that's something that maybe people don't always fully grasp. I mean, it's only recently that the models have been converging on the idea that there will be less precipitation in the Southwest. But it's been clear for some time that it's going to get warmer. And even if the precipitation doesn't change, if it gets warmer, that means more precipitation will fall as rain rather than snow. It's just going to be too warm in the winter to snow. And what snow there is will melt sooner, and that is happening. It's been observed now for some time. And as that happens, it changes the flow of water in the stream, and in particular, basically, the snowpack acts as a reservoir that holds on to the water until the people really need it in the summer. If you move the maximum stream flow to earlier in the year by melting the snow, then the water's coming when you don't need it. And your reservoirs may even be full, and you have to release the water, which is sort of every water manager's nightmare out there, of having to let this water go unused down the river, you know. So merely by warming the climate, you can get an effective water shortage that way, even if the rain or the total amount of precipitation does not decrease. Just last week, in fact, there was a paper in Science magazine by Barnett of Scripps Institute of Oceanography et al., and documenting that what they say are long-term trends over the past half century in the hydrology of the West, and linking it to global warming, saying basically pointing the finger at man-made global warming as the cause of a decrease in snowpack and a decrease in stream flow linked to warmer winters.
And much of this will be covered in your upcoming book, will it? Can you tell us a little bit more about that book?
Well, the book is called Fixing Climate, and it's coming out in April from Farrar Straus. And my co-author is Wally Broker, who is a pioneering climate scientist of the Lamont Doherty Observatory at Columbia University. He's the man who, basically, if you've heard of the conveyor belt in the ocean that is linked to sudden climate change, he's the guy who, that's his theory. Mm-hmm. And so he's been a pioneer of the idea that climate in the past has been subject to rapid, abrupt change. And so a lot of the book is talking about the study of the Ice Age and the past climate in general and how we've come to understand. I mean, it's really, if I can back up just 1 second, if there are two things we've learned about climate that are of fundamental importance in the past 50 years, or the two most important things. One is that we're capable of changing it, and that we are, in fact, changing it by putting greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the other is that climate is not a smoothly varying, stable system, but that on its own, naturally, it tends to go through abrupt shifts. And so you put those two together, and what it does is it tells you that, you know, global warming would be a serious challenge even if it comes at us smoothly and predictably, with the temperature slowly rising and ice slowly melting. But if, in fact, the climate has tipping points, to use the current buzzword, where it suddenly shifts into a new regime, that makes the whole thing a lot more dangerous. So the book is about the studies that document that reality, that climate does, in fact, shift abruptly. And then we talk about a couple of the what we consider the two biggest challenges, which are basically having too much water where we don't want it and the sea level rising, and not enough water where we do want it, which is going to cause drought in places like the.
Okay, well, as we wrap up, is there a website you'd like to recommend?
I do not have a website. No, I'm sorry to say.
You are the last person in the universe, Robert.
I may well be,
Well, certainly people can tune into National Geographic magazine. I noticed.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Of course, National Geographic has a website. It's just nationalgeographic.com, and Lamont Daugherty of Columbia University has a website where there's lots of them. In fact, there's a very good one of the people I interviewed for the National Geographic article, one of these climate modelers, is at Lamont, and his name is Richard Seeger, and he has a very good website on drought in the West, S-E-A-G-E-R, at Lamont Daugherty. If you do a Google on Richard Seeger, you'll find it, and that gives lots of background on some.
Okay, well, we have been talking with Robert Kunzig, the author of Drying of the West, Find That Alarming and Important Story, in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. Robert, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. One way to curb consumption of fossil fuels in the hope of controlling climate change is a tax on carbon. The first carbon tax in North America has appeared in the Canadian province of British Columbia on the Wild West Coast. This really matters, people. It sets an example and may start a series of similar measures in the most progressive American states. Changing our tax structures can, as the Friends of Earth say, decarbonize the tax code. Governments can encourage some behaviors and discourage others through the tax system. For the past many decades, governments have been handing out subsidies to the oil and gas industry, as you know, to encourage energy development. Even though we know fossil fuels are wrecking the environment and people's lives, both the Canadian and the American government continue to give huge tax breaks, billions of dollars a year, to the oil sands, to the most profitable companies in the world like ExxonMobil, which made $39 billion in profits just last year. That tax system encourages the end of the climate as we know it. We've got to change it. But what if governments could penalize carbon production and encourage conservation and alternative energy through that same tax system? Like Schwarzenegger in California, the Premier of British Columbia has sworn to drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Since BC gets most of its power from hydroelectricity, the largest single source of greenhouse gases in that province is the transportation system, mainly cars and trucks. Isn't this just another big government tax grab? Carol Taylor, the finance minister for British Columbia, says no. They have announced a revenue-neutral plan. While the price of carbon goes up due to the added tax, the income tax rate will go down, and BC will mail a check for $100 to every resident, helping the poorest, they hope, who don't pay taxes. In balance, the government won't make a dime out of the new taxes, they say, and theoretically, it won't cost consumers any more either, providing over time they continue to seek out better energy solutions, like buying a more fuel-efficient car. The tax covers all the fossil fuels at the consumer level, including home heating oil. But it doesn't apply to gas and oil producers themselves, which is a big loophole, and the cement companies also get a free ride. The legislation isn't perfect, but it is still an important milestone. A group of 70 economists in the province called for this revenue-neutral carbon tax. It was backed by the largest environmental groups, and even the Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business, backed the plan. Business will also get a reduced tax rate to offset their higher carbon costs. Let's listen to BC Finance Minister Carol Taylor announce the first carbon tax in North America in the legislature. One note for listeners, the PST she refers to is the BC Provincial Sales Tax, which will be reduced or removed for some green alternatives.
The carbon tax will apply to a wide range of fossil fuels, including gasoline, diesel, coal, propane, natural gas, and home heating fuel, making it among the broadest and most comprehensive taxes of its kind in the world. It will start at a rate of $10 per ton of associated carbon or carbon equivalent emissions. That works out to 2.4 cents a liter at the gas pump, 2.8 cents a liter for diesel and home heating fuel. These initial rates are relatively low, and that is by design. It will give customers, consumers, business, industry, and the economy time to adapt to this new landscape. The rate per ton will rise by $5 a year for the next 4 years, reaching $30 a ton by 2012. I want to repeat, this tax will be 100% revenue neutral. We expect it to raise approximately $1.8 billion over 3 years. So we are committing now to reduce taxes by that amount. We are investing more than $1 billion over 4 years in a series of programs and tax incentives to help make greener choices easier, more accessible, more affordable. On the transportation side, we are providing a sales tax reduction for all vehicles that qualify for Transport Canada's Eco-Auto Rebate Program. That program offers rebates of up to $2,000. With this new PST reduction, drivers making greener choices could see additional savings for a total of up to $4,000. To help get some older vehicles off the road, we are expanding around the province our Scrap It program, which offers cash and other incentives for making cleaner choices. PST relief will be introduced for electric bicycles, scooters, electric motorcycles. Relief will be provided for short-term passenger vehicle rentals, and this one addresses the co-op car rental issue that has been brought forward this past fall. With this budget, we are also providing $30 million for the BC Green Ports Initiative, which will reduce emissions from commercial truck and ship traffic. Another $3 million will help reduce emissions from trucks by using technology to assess their compliance with regulations while they're moving instead of making every vehicle stop for inspection, and by providing plug-ins at key truck stops so that big rigs don't have to idle their engines. We will also provide a PST exemption for aerodynamic devices that make commercial trucks more fuel efficient. As well, with this budget, we're funding the initial phase of the $14 billion transit plan announced last month, a plan designed to double transit ridership by 2020. Very important changes, considering that transportation is the leading contributor to BC's greenhouse gas emissions. On the home energy side, $60 million has been budgeted for energy audits and conservation retrofit incentives for homeowners. This money will help individuals and families assess where they can best invest to bring down their own home energy costs. If you do decide to renovate your home, a tax exemption will be provided on insulation for hot water tanks, pipes, and ductwork. Energy Star rated fridges, freezers, and washing machines will also be exempt from PST, completing and complementing the rebate programs offered by utilities and, in some cases, by local and regional governments. To support the province's goal of achieving energy self-sufficiency, this budget sets aside $20 million for remote communities that now depend on diesel generators to switch to cleaner, renewable power sources, and this will be a benefit for many of our First Nations communities. Provides a PST exemption on production machinery and equipment used by local governments for power production and cogeneration. And we're investing $5 million to expand solar power initiatives. These investments complement our 2007 BC Energy Plan, the cleanest, the greenest of its kind in North America. We are also investing $3 million for our energy-efficient building strategy, in keeping with the goal of meeting more of our new energy needs through conservation. Each of these initiatives brings us one step closer to the future that we envision for our province. It's a future where we leverage our action on climate change in ways that support our quality of life and our economy with new innovations, new ideas, and new technologies.
To give you a quick snapshot of carbon tax in other countries, I'm just going to quote directly from the Wikipedia entry. Quote, on January 1, 1991, Sweden enacted a carbon tax, placing a tax of 0.25 SEK per kilogram, that's $100 per ton, on the use of oil, coal, natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, petrol, and aviation fuel used in domestic travel. Industrial users paid half the rate between 1993 and 1997, and certain high-energy industries such as commercial horticulture, mining, manufacturing, and the pulp and paper industry were fully exempted from these tax rates. In 1997, the tax rate was raised again. In 2007, Sweden will raise taxes on carbon emissions. Finland, the Netherlands, and Norway also introduced carbon taxes in the 1990s. The United Kingdom Treasury imposed the fuel price escalator, an incrementally increasing pollution tax on retail petroleum products from 1993. The increases stopped after politically damaging fuel protests in 1999, at which time the tax and duty represented more than 75% of the total pump price. Tax now represents about two-thirds of the pump price in the UK. In 2005, New Zealand proposed a carbon tax, setting an emissions price of New Zealand $15 per ton of CO2 equivalent. The planned tax was scheduled to take effect from April 2007 and applied across most economic sectors, though with an exemption for methane emissions from farming and provisions for special exemptions from carbon-intensive business if they adopted the world's best practice standards. After the 2005 election, the minor party supporting the government opposed the proposed tax, and it was abandoned in December 2005. In the United States, in 1993, President of the United States, Bill Clinton, proposed a BTU tax that was never adopted. His vice president, Al Gore, had strongly backed a carbon tax in his book, Earth in the Balance, but this became a political liability after the Republicans attacked him as, quote, a dangerous fanatic. In 2000, when Gore ran for president, one commentator labeled Gore's carbon tax proposal a central planning solution, harking back to the New Deal politics of his father in April 2005. Paul Anderson, CEO and chairman of Duke Energy, called for the introduction of a carbon tax. In January 2007, economist Charles Komenoff and attorney Dan Rosenblum launched a carbon tax center to give voice to Americans who believe that taxing carbon emissions is imperative to reduce global warming. And that brief history of the carbon tax comes from Wikipedia. You can find out more about the American situation at www.carbontax.org. Of course, in September of 2007, Michigan Representative John Dingell proposed what he called a hybrid carbon tax. The bill had some really appealing ideas. In addition to a carbon tax, which included things like jet fuel, Dingell's bill called for an end to tax subsidies for monster houses over 4,200 square feet. There were many other measures. But the major green groups couldn't support any climate change initiative coming from that dark representative of Detroit. Mr. Dingell had led the charge year after year to prevent any meaningful fuel efficiency regulations for American car producers. Greenpeace descended on the parking lot of Dingell's district office, transforming it into a car dealership for gas guzzlers. After years of betrayal on CAFE fuel efficiency standards, where America has dragged behind Europe for decades, Dingell's bill seemed too much like Dick Cheney selling face protection armor for hunters. Meanwhile, America has been more focused on the alternative carbon reduction plan called Cap and Trade. This works more with original big polluters rather than consumers. For example, a giant coal-fired electricity plant in Ohio could pay for better burning coal equipment in China or even replanting some rainforest rather than cut back on their own emissions. The cap-and-trade system did work in the United States to help bring down sulfur emissions that were killing off lakes and forests with acid rain. But the international situation with greenhouse gases is much more complex. Cap and trade is open to wild abuse and corruption, which we have already found. I've seen reports of one Chinese company which made $800 million just by not opening a proposed polluting plant. Meanwhile, the original polluter kept on pouring out the greenhouse gases. We didn't really win anything from that. All the super capitalists on Wall Street back the cap-and-trade option. They are already testing out futures markets to make money out of climate change. These are the same people who just brought us the subprime and collateralized debt fiasco, which may, incidentally, bring down the whole economy we've been talking about. Frankly, it stinks. The carbon tax option is much more honest and likely to work, in my opinion. Oh, and by the way, Al Gore happens to have my opinion as well. We may eventually have some combination of efforts. Certainly the British Columbia plan isn't strong enough to really protect the climate. The province intends to keep on making money itself by selling off oil and gas rights and taxing production. It is in the oil and gas business, the province is. Well, maybe that's why the original producers got off with no taxes. Surprise, surprise. But climate scientists like Andrew Weaver, a lead IPCC author, and Mark Jacquard, an expert in government carbon control, have backed the British Columbia carbon tax as an excellent start in a long process. Ian Bruce, climate campaigner for the David Suzuki Foundation, said, "It's a landmark decision in North America as far as governments taking strong action on climate change." You can find out more about the BC carbon tax from the best online source, the Tyee magazine. That's spelled T-Y-E-E. So the website is thetyee.ca. To wrap things up, here's an economist from the University of British Columbia, David Green. He was one of the 70 economists pushing for this legislation and a member of VTAC, Voters Taking Action on Climate Change. This clip comes from the Canadian TV broadcaster, the CBC.
For one thing, you should be clear, big business is going to be paying this as well. But really, ultimately, the power does lie with the consumers. If everyone changes, we're actually going to be able to have an impact here. You have to recognize what we're looking at is really a change in lifestyle. To do what BC wants, a one-third cut in greenhouse gas emissions, is huge. So You're going to need everybody really doing things to generate real change here.
Check out our website at ecoshock.org, and here's a tiny bit from Andy Sloan as Hummer Man.
Your voice fades and I'm lost in the shades and the system. Sucker tried to pass, so I laugh, yeah, I dissed him. 120 in a 55 zone. I'm leaving both you and the cops in the dust all alone. 8 miles to the gallon, but the tank is big, and one day I might have to save my wife and kids. When I pass, you'll hear it, you'll fear it. Got the pioneer spirit that made America great. The liberals hate, they stare at you, just jealous. Muttering something about he's so selfish. Their hatred is evident, the Hummer is heaven sent. Best of all, I'll write it off, thanks, Mr. President. I spend what I need on the rims and the trim. And I can speed across the country on a whim. I can move any mountain, I can forward any stream. Chirp the tires in the parking lot to let off steam.
He's a rich guy.
Just as U.S. President George Bush hit a record low approval rating of 19%, the conservative Canadian government steps in to copy another lame duck move. Like Bush, Canada will now muzzle its climate scientists. Just what we need. All calls from the press must go to the communications officers in the capital, who will answer with approved lines. Environment Canada staff were advised to follow the policy of, quote, one department, one voice. The department wants no surprises for the minister, John Baird. Several Canadians were lead authors on the latest intergovernmental panel on climate change. They are in demand as experts in everything from Arctic ice to global weather impacts. Now, like NASA scientist James Hansen, the country's scientists are being told to follow the political line. It is anti-scientific and a recipe for further disaster. Luckily, I happened to record one top Canadian scientist just a week before this edict was sent out. You can download the whole 28-minute speech by Dr. John Fife of Environment Canada from our website. Just look at the climate change page of ecoshock.org. Here is the introduction and then the last part of the speech by Dr. John Fife. On January 24, 2008, the Columbia Institute hosted top Canadian climate scientist John Fife at a plenary session for educators in British Columbia. The event was Through the Green Glass, a climate symposium for education leaders. The speech outlines the latest information on climate change and our prospects for the future. Here is Columbia's Executive Director, Charlie Beresford, introducing Dr. John Fife.
We had in the evolution of the tipping point, we had some mileposts along the way. There was Al Gore and An Inconvenient Truth. There was the Stern Report. There was some incredibly challenging weather. And then there was the International Panel on Climate Change. And we are blessed to have with us today a member of the Nobel Peace Prize team that shared the Peace Prize with Al Gore. His name is John Fife. And in addition to being a member of that team, John has also been an author of the Arctic Climate Impacts Assessment. He is an adjunct professor with the University of Victoria, and he's a research scientist with the Canadian Centre for Climate Modelling and Analysis of Environment Canada. So, John, may I welcome you to the stage.
So that's, you know, sea ice is melting. And now we turn into the second part of this presentation, and that is, you know, why is this happening? And this is the so-called, you know, attribution and detection problem. You know, scientists like these big, you know, phrases because it makes us look, you know, really intelligent. But the basic question is, why is this happening? The way we get at this question is by using climate models. These are very sophisticated computer models. They're based on sound physical principles, and they're validated in very sophisticated ways. They're run on supercomputers. Climate scientists like me are the biggest users of computers on the planet. You know, there's really no contest. Every major industrialized country has a group like the group I'm in Victoria, or maybe one or two, and we all develop these models and compete, you know, to produce the best one. They're run on supercomputers. We have a very big, fancy computer in our organization, as do the Japanese. This is a picture, I hope you can see it, on the bottom. That cluster of 10-story buildings on the left is where the nerdy climate scientists work. The building on the right is the computer. It's the size of a football field, and it's powered by a nuclear reactor. It's massive. The mouse that's used to control the thing is as big as this table. That's science, you know, attempt at humor. That's why we stick at science and stay away from talk shows and so on. But we have this massive computer, and these climate groups a few years ago launched a set of experiments, each group in the world, and we all compared our results, and we produced this plot coming out now, which is really the cornerstone of this IPCC report. And what it shows you in the solid black line is temperature from 1900 to present as it was observed, okay? So the black is the observations. And all of those red lines are the different computer models from around the world, okay, following these standardized runs. And you can see that the models closely resemble the observations and each other. So this is a very good thing. It tells us that the models are able to reproduce the historical variation in temperature and the rise in temperature very, very well, okay? So that's part of the validation exercise. The important thing is that this is not possible if not for increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. If the models did not have the fact that, you know, carbon dioxide is increasing in the models, they do not show warming, okay? They show instead, in the next picture here, in all of these blue lines right there. So this is now the same experiments run where we excluded increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In other words, we didn't let, you know, carbon dioxide build in the atmosphere. And if that were the case, these models would tell us we would be global cooling rather than global warming. So it's really the separation between these red curves that show global warming and the blue curves that show that you wouldn't have it if you didn't have increasing greenhouse gases is really what is behind the statement in the IPCC that it's very likely that humans were the cause of the rise in temperature of 1 degree C that we saw over the last century. And we assigned a probability of about 90%. You know, it's 90% probable. It's, you know, pretty well certain that we were the cause of all of this. And this is why, you know, we're kind of organized today in this room to address this issue. And now we, you know, turn to the future. In the same way that these models can be used to look at the past, they can be used to look into the future. And that's what's demonstrated here in a graph that's more, you know, busier than it needs to be for what I want to say. You want to look only at, you know, one part of this figure, and that's, you know, go to 2005. And again, this is temperature change. Start at 2005 and follow the set of three curves that go up to the upper right-hand side. There's a red one, a green one, and a black one, okay? So these are our model projections of what is in store for the future in terms of temperature. And the curves themselves differ in terms of the amount of emissions we project. One of the curves is a low emission scenario, one is a medium emission scenario, and one is a high emission scenario. And the point I want to make is that regardless of which scenario path we go towards, at year 2025, we're going to end up at the same place. So we're doomed, okay? We have stuck ourselves into a situation where within the next 20 years, we're going to end up at the same place regardless of what we do. And that has to do with the fact that we've put enough carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that we have to live with its consequences for at least the next 20 years and suffer another half a degree rise. Okay, so that's the doom and gloom and, you know, down part of the presentation. The next bit, in an ironic way, is the upside of the story. And this is now where you look even further into the future. Let's go past 2025 and out to 2100 or thereabouts. And a different kind of presentation, but the same information. We have three curves going from 2000 out to 2100. Again, there's a red one, a blue one, and a black one. And again, these represent low, medium, and high emission scenarios. And now you can see, when you get out to the end of this century, that the pathway that we take in terms of emissions will make a big difference. It'll make the difference between, at year 2100, a 1 degree rise in the average temperature of the atmosphere, or perhaps a 4 degree rise if we choose a high emission scenario. And so the message here is that the choices that we make today will make a big difference by the end of the century. That is, within the lifetime of our children, and most certainly their children. And this is the kind of thing, you know, that we have to, it's a long ways away, but we have to start making changes now. And in fact, by 2020, you know, the kind of canonical thinking is that we need to have turned the corner by at least 2020. We have to have start reducing emissions. You know, we're on an uphill. We have to go on the downhill by 2020, or we may be headed into dangerous climate change, which is thought to be around, you know, the 3 to 4 degree temperature rise in the globally average temperature would be a really bad place to be. Okay, next. Okay, so now just a few, and you know, kind of getting to the end of this part of the talk, I'm just going to give you a sense of some of the things that we expect to see by the end of the century if we follow kind of a medium emissions scenario. You should expect sea level rise. So this is pretty clear that sea level is rising. It's expected to rise more, and by the end of the century, it's expected to rise about half a meter on average. It's going to be more in some places and less in others, and that's just reflected by the variation in shades here from blue to red. Some places will be impacted more than others, which is another message from the climate scientists. So this is, it's a global phenomena, but with regional impacts. Different areas are impacted in different ways. Next, expect, this is now temperature change out to 2100. The other thing you ought to know, if you don't know it already, is that the largest warming is reserved for land, unfortunately where we live, and at the highest latitudes, and in particular the Arctic. And that accounts for why we've seen such dramatic change in the Arctic to date, and why we expect there to be, you know, even more dramatic change in the future. And it also accounts for the reason why Canadians ought to especially take great interest in this climate change problem. Precipitation. So, you know, I'm, you know, nerdy kind of meteorologist guy, and I think, you know, temperature and precipitation are not these kind of sexy things like intertidal zones and so on. But precipitation, you should expect regional precipitation change. In general, we expect the atmosphere to become more moist. As the atmosphere warms, its capacity to hold moisture increases. So we expect a wetter atmosphere. But where that water falls out is going to vary around the globe. And we expect in our region, by evidence by these blue shades, that we will have increased precipitation over time. And where you see the kind of red-yellow shades is where we expect to see decreased precipitation. So increased precipitation at the high, mid and high latitudes, decreased precipitation in the subtropics. Okay, next. So that's, you know, temperature and precipitation, the kind of mean changes. We also have a lot of new information about climate extremes, you know, weird weather. We hear a lot about that. We can now, you know, report on climate extremes where we weren't able to report, you know, in years gone by. We have now information that tells us that when we get rain, it's going to be heavier. And this would be consistent, and it's shown in this graphic here. This would be consistent, for example, with what we saw last winter. I don't know if you remember. We had this, you know, sequence of, you know, unprecedented storms that brought unprecedented amounts of moisture very quickly, you know, and swamped out the reservoir here and affected our water supply. You ought to expect this to happen more and more often, these heavy precipitation events. We expect there to be more drought. So in the summertime, for example, in, you know, southwestern British Columbia, we expect the drought conditions to occur more frequently and last longer, okay? And globally speaking, this is consistent with what we've already seen. We've seen, for example, in Australia, you know, unprecedented drought conditions and wildfires and so on. We saw the Atlanta drought this summer. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in Atlanta, you know, they're running out of moisture. When I was traveling in the U.S., this was the big issue. We had the California wildfires. We have all of these, you know, big news bullets. You're going to hear more and more about these things is what the expectation is. Connected with that, we should expect more heat waves, like the European heat wave of 2003. We expect there to be, you know, more and more of these kinds of events affecting humans and infecting crops and affecting the natural environment in many important and far-reaching ways. And then we have, you know, other aspects of the climate system. You know, I'm just talking here about the natural kind of physical part of the system, but there's the whole living part, and it's being impacted. I won't go into that. There's a lot of information out there to describe, you know, the impact of climate change on humans, animals, fish, and so on. We have, for example, longer growing seasons is what should be expected for the mid and high latitudes. This has to do with the rising temperatures and more precipitation. Okay. Winners and losers. It is the case that there are winners and losers in this story. I won't go into any detail, but this relates to the fact that climate change in the physical environment is regional. It's different in different locales. And then finally, the sort of three key messages for you. If you could take away three key messages. The first one is from the IPCC report that the climate has warmed. This is now unequivocal. Will continue to warm. This is very likely. And humans are the cause. This is very, very likely. We have that mitigation will not substantially affect the climate over the next few decades. That relates to the fact that this cluster of curves just stay stuck together, as I noted earlier. But choices that we make now will have a big impact on the climate of the 21st century. So it does matter that you folks are, you know, assembled today to talk about going carbon neutral. We have to do that today, and it's only one small part of the equation, and it's a complicated one. Thank you.
That was Dr. John Fife, a member of the Nobel Peace Prize team of the IPCC, author of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, an adjunct professor with the University of Victoria, and a research scientist for the Canadian Centre for Climate Modelling and Analysis of Environment Canada. The whole idea that our climate will change radically within our lifetimes is so difficult to grasp personally. Every time I listen to a climate expert explaining our real situation, something new seems to sink in. Although I had read the IPCC summary report, plowed through many news articles, as I'm sure you did, and while I've listened to hours of audio, Dr. Fife emphasized something I had failed to really digest. All the projected scenarios of our future, whether they're based on low-carbon changes now or business as usual with the smokestacks a-blaring, all of these projected scenarios, made by our best expertise and supercomputers of the Earth, suggest that we are, well, doomed to suffer climate change in the next few decades, no matter what we do. Now, that is sobering. We will cut down on fossil fuels somehow, I'm sure. Many of us will choose less convenient things, fewer products, smaller cars and houses, rather than continue to wreck the atmosphere. Our economies may founder a bit in the attempt to save ourselves, and still, despite our sacrifices, the world as a whole will get hotter, the seas will rise, species will disappear, it will happen from the carbon we've already put out there. The short-sighted public will surely get tired of the new rules, the taxes, and limits to their former consumption. Why bother giving up carbon when Mother Nature is punishing us anyway, they will say. The environmentalists have failed us. Our leaders mislead. But, and this is huge, a real reduction in greenhouse gases, starting as soon as possible, will determine whether the world is really livable by 2100. That's what Dr. John Fife has to say for us. For the first time in European-based civilization, there must be a willing reduction, something that does not benefit us, but acts to preserve our grandchildren. We are called to save the stability of the planet's climate for all coming generations. Surely this will inspire us in new ways. We have a goal that is greater than ourselves, a gift to pass down in time. And I'm not alone in this desperate hope that humans can and really will turn this around. Just this week, I heard that optimism in an interview with Simon Fraser University professor Bruce Alexander. The topic was globalization of addiction, not just drugs, but all our addictions, from gambling to our fake second lives lived out for us on television, in games, and on the net. Here is that clip from the penetrating weekly program called Red Eye from CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Well, we have to do it because, we're in a time of crisis. We may well be going into an economic collapse. We're definitely going into an environmental collapse. People sometimes say to me, well, you know, you're naive. You're talking about changing this system. But I'm not naive. You're naive if you're saying, well, this system can't be changed because it's gonna crush us. It has to be changed, and I believe it. I have faith that you know, people will come to the rescue. Really, people will rise up and insist on the kinds of changes we need. Well, I have to believe that.
Well, it's great to hear that kind of hope. And it's been great talking to you this morning, and I really look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with SFU Professor Emeritus Bruce Alexander. His new book, The Globalization of Addiction, will be released in August by the Oxford University Press.
Find all the Red Eye interviews at www.cooperadio.org/redeye. And that's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Grab all our features and a lot of good green audio for free from our website at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith, finally with a happier ending and a hope that change is growing out of the dark. I've just come from a good place where the Latin music pours out into the hot Havana night. Just for something different, we'll go out with a group you won't find anywhere on the net. Well, you won't hear it anywhere else. This is the homemade album for El Grupo Santiago y Habana from the club Monserrate on Viejo Habana. Adios, muchachos.